Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Chinese startup DeepSeek unveiled IA technology recently that stunned the U.S. tech community and served notice that their technology could be cheaper, smarter, and more innovative than what U.S. companies are turning out. But OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, says it has evidence that DeepSeek used its technology. Here to explain more is Miami University Associate Professor Arthur Carvalho. He teaches information systems analytics at the Farmer School of Business at Miami University in Oxford. Welcome to the show, Professor Carvalho.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Amy.
So you also work on the deployment and development of AI techniques. So did you know about DeepSeek prior to about 10 days ago when everyone else found out about it?
Yes, absolutely. So I played with the model quite often, and it's absolutely fascinating, some aspects of the model. So in my opinion, it's not really the quality of ChatGPT or Gemini, but there's one interesting aspect, which is the thought process. When you ask a query and you get a response, the model can give you very detailed thought process, how the model came up with that response. So it almost looks like there's a human being there struggling to come up with an answer, to give you an answer. And that to me was absolutely fascinating about that model by DeepSeek.
Okay. So what can you tell me about the company behind DeepSeek? Are they new or have they been around for a while?
Absolutely. So if you go back a few years ago, there's a Chinese quantitative hedge fund company called Highflyer. So Highflyer is quite successful. They built a $14 billion portfolio using AI models. So they developed AI models to make investment decisions. So if you fast forward to 2023, Highflyer created a new independent research group, and that's called DeepSeek. So the goal of DeepSeek is to advance AI all the way to what we call AGI, which stands for Artificial General Intelligence. So that's the main purpose of DeepSeek now, developing these models so that we can achieve or even surpass human capacity in terms of solving problems. So we are talking about DeepSeek today for, I would say, four primary points. So number one, as you mentioned before, Amy, point number one is the release of highly accurate, very high performance AI models, like something called R1. So R1 is the model I mentioned before that has a tremendous thought process behind it. And there are some benchmarks that show that R1 is getting really close to models developed by American companies like ChatGPT, like Claude, like Gemini by Google. So that was point number one, very high quality, good quality model. So point number two is about the costs. As you mentioned before, and in the very beginning, there are claims now that DeepSeek delivered that model for $5.7 million, which of course is a lot of money. But when you compare against American companies, that's peanuts. So there are some estimates now that American companies are spending potentially hundreds of millions of dollars to develop their AI models. So 5.7, again, it's actually peanuts. So point number two, again, cost. Point number three, that was really surprising, and that's open source, which means anyone can download that model right now to your computer, assuming your computer is really powerful, and you can run that model locally inside your computer. So if you look at companies like, you know, OpenAI and Google and Anthropic, companies behind some of the American models, you can actually download their models to your computer. So you have to send your query to be executed inside the servers of these companies. And these companies, of course, will send the response back to you. That's not really being executed locally. And of course, we have a bunch of privacy concerns there. And the last one is a Chinese company. So because it's a Chinese company, if you look at the experts, there were a bunch of numbers in terms of gap. The most popular number was 2 years. So there was close to consensus that China was lagging behind the United States in terms of AI development. And most people would say that's about 2 years. And out of nowhere, we realized that the gap is there, but it's not really 2 years at all. That gap is closing very, very, very quickly. despite some of the US AI chip embargoes going on. So those are the four major points why we are discussing DeepSeek today.
Yes. So we are talking about DeepSeek on Tech Tuesday on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News with Miami University Associate Professor Arthur Carvalho. So Professor Carvalho, let's go back to point two for a second, the money. So you called $5.7 million peanuts, which I understand is peanuts considering how much money all these tech companies are moving around all of the time. How could they make it so much cheaper? Is it really true that it is that much cheaper than what the U.S. is doing?
So yeah, we have to look at that number very carefully to avoid overreaction. So the $5.7 million is the price to train the last model they deployed, the R1 model. So that number, the 5.7, does not really include at all research and development efforts. So to get to that one model, that final model, there's a lot of preliminary models, a lot of experimentation going on, things that will not be deployed in real life, and that costs money as well. So we also have to look at the salaries of employees, of the researchers. So it's not part of that $5.7 million. So that number, again, we have to be careful when we look at that number. So, but nonetheless, it's impressive. If we only look at the cost of training that last module, $5.7 million is impressive. So how did they achieve that? By being very clever, really, really clever in terms of code optimization, algorithmic innovation. So they did a lot of software engineering, some sort of tweaking, changing the architecture of some of the AI models to be considerably more efficient. Because we have to remember, China right now, at least officially, does not have access to some of the most powerful chips out there, most powerful GPUs, because of the AI chip embargo the United States imposed. So they had to be clever in terms of the codes, the execution, to be able to run that on, for the lack of a better expression, second-class chips, chips that are not as powerful as the ones used by American companies. So in a nutshell, it was algorithmic innovation. That's what drove the success of DeepSeek.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about those chips for a second, because here in Ohio, those chips are very important to us. We're spending money to build facilities to make the chips of the future. So if you can make better technology with lower level chips just by being clever, what does that say for what we're doing with investing in companies like Intel and their chip building factories?
Absolutely. And that's the question that was on investors' mind a few days ago when the markets came close to a crash. If you look at NVIDIA, for example, it was close to 17% drop in one day. And if I remember correctly, that was the record, a one day, the record in terms of one day loss in market capitalization, because that was the question inside investors' minds. Like, do we need that many powerful, expensive chips to run state-of-the-art AI models? So, but let's make no mistake here. These chips helped tremendously. The CEO of DeepSeek, in an interview, actually said the main barrier now to their success is having access to these state-of-the-art chips. Mm. So they were able to do things incredibly successfully using second-class chips if they had access to the most powerful ones. Who knows how good this model would be. So again, the chips will be important. Investments in infrastructure, the data centers will be important as well. But equally important, and that's part of the discussion now, will be the algorithmic innovations. All the engineering, all the tweaking the models. It's not only about data centers and machineries, but also the clever part of tweaking that AI model.
Let's talk about it being clever, the actual model, for a second, because you asked it to create a poem about love. Can you tell me how that went and how it executed it and what impressed you about it?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I enjoyed the most, which is just playing with these models. I asked a few questions. One of them was about the poem. I asked to create poems about love, but with some elements of sadness and a bit of death as well. And we could see a response. Before the model came up with a response, the model was, quote unquote, thinking. And you can see the entire thinking chair, the thought process going on. And it was absolutely outstanding to just look at how this machine was thinking very close to humans. Like the machine was like, literally printing a thought process saying, first, how do I represent love? Maybe through roses or stars, but sadness and death, they need to be present too. And I'm reading now what the model was saying literally.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe use symbols like flowers, shadows, or winter, snow. And you can see how it's fascinating. Like for us humans to see machines having this thought process very similar to ours, it's an absolutely fascinating endeavor. And of course, at the same time, we have to be careful about the bias as well, and some answers that are not really as nice as that one.
Yeah. Oh, so when you think about new technology coming out for the first time, sometimes it's a hit and sometimes it ends up being a flop. So with DeepSeek, I know that a lot of people tried to download it all at once, and for like just, a hot minute, the company had a few problems. But with so many people trying to access it at the same time, but is it working? Everyone who tried to access it now, can people still get it? Is it working well, or is it going to be a fad? Kind of like I'm trying to think of something that didn't go over well, like when Google Glass came out, and then suddenly no one cared about it.
Yeah, it's hard to predict the future because we have so many players now developing AI models. Only in China, there are close to six or seven big companies developing AI models. I mentioned before in the United States, we have at least three big ones with Google, OpenAI, and Anthropic. So it's hard to say which ones will stay alive down the road. But what I can say about DeepSeek is that they offer. Number one, they're clever now because they offer their models for absolutely free, no constraints at all. So they are building that user base massively now. And the way that companies use these models, they use differently than you and me, like end users. Companies use something called API, Application Programming Interface. In other words, they pay per usage. And the price that DeepSeek is charging now, these companies like pay per usage, is 20 to 50 times lower than what OpenAI is charging in the United States. So they are very aggressive now, trying to grow that user base, trying to make sure that people use these products, not only end users, but companies as well. But again, at least in my opinion, the quality of DeepSeek and more broadly, the Chinese models are not really there yet in relation to ChatGPT, in relation to Claude or Gemini, the American produced models.
Okay, so what does the US do now? Do we need to are the US companies who are working on improving ChatGPT and their AI models, do they need to change the way they're doing anything because of DeepSeek?
Yes, absolutely. So one amazing thing about DeepSeek, and I applaud them for that. They released a report. When they released that model I mentioned before, R1, they had a 20 plus page report detailing a lot of innovations, really clever innovations, scientific discoveries, clever mathematics. And make no mistake, American companies will look at that report carefully and try to incorporate some of that inside their models. So that's the very short term. It's just happening right now. So that's number one. Number two, of course, American companies will start looking more as well at algorithmic innovations, not only building data centers, more machines, but also perhaps investing more and more into research, fundamental research, to try to create new versions of their models that perhaps are more efficient. And at the same time, we have to have some concerns about, let's say, foreign companies having access to American company to American models as well. So there are potential rumors there that DeepSeek and other Chinese companies are kind of copying the models by American companies. By copying the models, you can think this way. If I go to ChatGPT and ask a question, I get an answer. If I ask 100,000 questions, I get 100,000 answers. If I ask 5 million questions, I have 5 million answers. So guess what? I can now have a data set of questions and answers that I can use to somehow create a model myself. And that's what we call distillation. Build a small model based on a big one. So it begs the questions now, it begs the question big time. What prevents DeepSeek or another startup, small player, coming up with cheaper, smaller models distilled from American companies, from these big models, from companies that invested billions of dollars, And they can sell these models now, access to these models for pennies, or do what DeepSeek did, like pretty much give it for free. So OpenAI, the American company, said that no, they have some evidence, solid evidence, that DeepSeek did that. That DeepSeek was constantly pulling data from ChatGPT, and distillation happened to a certain degree.
Okay, well, we only have about a minute left, but I'll have to ask you the big question, China. So, because the United States is not very happy with the whole TikTok situation regarding China right now. So, is this going to be the next because of DeepSeek and what they have done with their technology? Is it the next thing that is going to be taken up by Washington, D.C. to ban another app, another company?
It could be, it could potentially have bans in place, but what I believe is going to happen even more so is to have stronger, even stronger embargoes to make sure that Chinese companies, not only Chinese, but companies from Russia, Iran, North Korea, that companies there, they don't have access to the latest technologies produced by US. So you can think about bans or embargoes in terms of, let's say, Chinese companies not having access to ChatGPT anymore because of they can start doing distillation processes, or not only embargoes on chip, on machinery, but potentially on software as well. So that's perhaps one I can foresee that happening in a short to medium term way. In terms of banning completely these models, that's going to be super hard. Just remember that DeepSeek is open source. It's all over the web. I actually have a version of DeepSeek running on my computer close to me now. So banning it now, given that's out in the wild, is going to be really hard.
That was Miami University Associate Professor Arthur Carvalho. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the year of the glacier. That's when Tech Tuesday continues on all sides on 89.7 NPR News. Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. 2025 is the International Year of Glacier Preservation. With a goal to increase global awareness of the important role glaciers, snow, and ice play in the Earth's climate system. And glaciers have been melting at an alarming rate, causing negative consequences to the social, economic, and environmental conditions of the Earth. Joining us is Lonnie Thompson, a faculty member in the School of Earth Sciences and the lead of the Ice Core Paleoclimatology Research Group at Ohio State. Welcome to All Sides, Lonnie.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And also with us is Brian Mark, faculty member in the Geography Department and leader of the Glacial Environmental Change Research Group at Ohio State. Brian, thanks for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So, Lonnie, you've been researching and documenting glaciers for decades. Your efforts have shown glacier retreat and clear evidence that glaciers around the world are melting due to global warming. So, can you tell us why it's important to study the ice that comes from glaciers? What does it tell us?
Well, there are many many aspects of this. Glaciers serve as recorders in that they have recorded in them a history of climate on the planet. So we use ice cores to recover that. But they are also responders to climate change. And in today's world, this is something that we're very concerned about. We've been studying the glaciers, mountaintop glaciers, the highest glaciers on this planet for the last 50 years. And unfortunately, they are retreating. And in many parts of the world, the people who live downstream that depend on those glaciers for their water for irrigation, for municipal water supplies, for power, hydropower. They're all at risk as these glaciers not only retreat, but it's really the acceleration and the rate of retreat that we're really, really concerned about.
Now, Brian, why did we decide to name 2025 the International Year of Glacier Preservation?
Great question. It almost sounds crazy to think about preserving glaciers, but the whole idea is to get people to think about glaciers and how important they are, and to realize that the only way that we could feasibly stop the rate or decelerate the rate of loss would be to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, because that's the main driver of what's causing all this melt now. So I think the UN, UNESCO, and the World Meteorological Organization got together, and there was a, I think, a resolution in 2022 to make this year the year of glacier preservation, and then every year, March 21st, to think about glaciers as the Day of Glaciers.
Lonnie, you've been researching glaciers for a long time. What do you think declaring 2025 the year of the glacier is going to do for awareness building?
Well, I think it. Most people don't think about glaciers unless you live in an area that's happens to have glaciers, like Alaska or some places on the in the West here in the U.S. But they're a very important part of our climate system. We have over 10% of the glaciers on this planet cover land surfaces. So the whole idea is to raise awareness. And hopefully to motivate the general public to do something on this issue. And as Brian says, this, we know what the cause is. It's the rising levels of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, and we have to curtail those.
Lonnie, tell me what it's like to collect an ice core. What is that process like?
Well, it's a challenge. I'll tell you about our latest drilling over on the Huascarán down in the Andes of Peru. This is the highest tropical mountain on Earth. And when you think about moving 6 tons of equipment and the people up to these drill sites, and one of the drill sites was at 20,000 feet, and the upper ones were at 22,205 feet. So just getting a team and getting your field equipment into these really remote areas is quite a challenge, and it takes a lot of people working together to make this happen. And of course, we do a lot of work in the low latitudes in the tropics. And when you're drilling at 22,000 feet, you're in the polar regions. But at the base of that mountain, there are palm trees. So you have to be very quick in transporting frozen ice cores off of that mountain and getting them into freezer trucks and ultimately into on commercial flights to send the ice back to Ohio State where it can be examined. So it takes a lot of planning, and it takes a lot of collaboration with the countries in which we've worked. And we've recovered ice cores from 16 different countries in addition to Antarctica and Greenland. So I think it shows what's possible, that we can collaborate on these difficult tasks and we can have success.
And Brian, tell me more about the collecting of the ice cores and their importance to you and your research.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me just say it's an honor to have worked with Lonnie Thompson and his wife, Ellen Mosley Thompson, who was my advisor for my master's degree. The only ice cores that I've recovered were actually working with her on South Pole Station, where we collected six short
Oh, just
cores.
that, only the South Pole. Oh, yeah.
And that was back in the last century, okay, in the end of, well, the early 1990s. And the idea there was to think about snow accumulation. And it turns out that the polar regions are a desert. There are only 9 millimeters of water equivalent that falls in South Pole every year on average. And so, but it never melts, right? Exactly. It piles up, but it redistributes. And we needed to understand the rate of that accumulation. It turns out that in a warmer world, there's actually more snow accumulation because there's more humidity in the air. But let me just say that I learned something valuable about science from Lonnie. Lots of things, actually. But it's 90%, correct me if I'm wrong, Lonnie, but 90% persistence and maybe less than 10% inspiration. And Lonnie's the most driven man I've ever worked with. And he's very quiet and humble. But I would encourage folks to check out more of his personal history in the movie Canary. Mm. But also just to know that it's a lot of grunt work. This is not easy to get an ice core. And to keep it preserved at 40 below zero here in central Ohio is a testimony to Ohio State and to the infrastructure that we're able to, you know, bring to bear on this issue. And so keeping this going is really important work.
Well, Lonnie, is that correct? It's 90%. What did you say, 90%?
Persistence.
Is it 90% persistence to get an ice core?
It may be closer to 95. It does. You have to be truly passionate and dedicated to the effort. And of course, from a professor point of view, we are most proud of our students and their careers that they have once they get their degrees working with us on these ice cores.
This is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News from All Sides, and we're talking about glacier preservation with Lonnie Thompson, leader of the Ice Core Paleoclimatology Research Group at Ohio State, and Brian Mark is with us, leader of the Glacier Environmental Change Research Group at Ohio State. How did Ohio State become the hub of glacier research? Is it because of Lonnie Thompson?
Well, we have a lot of really important contributions that have been made, sustained over like more than 60 years. So when we think about interdisciplinary research centers on campus, they normally run the course about 10 years and then they dissipate. This one's been going for over 60 years. And before it was known as the Institute of Polar Studies. Mm. And we have some very famous researchers, including John Mercer, who back in the 70s was kind of a prophet, was able to sort of look ahead and see that as the world's increase in greenhouse gases was going unabated, that he predicted we might see first signs of this destabilization of what we call the cryosphere, ice and its frozen form of water, in the Antarctic Peninsula when the ice shelves start to break up. And lo and behold, that's happened. And that was happening as early 2000s. And things have started to accelerate from that point onwards. But anyway, so we have a long history, mm-hmm. but certainly when it comes to ice cores, it was Lonnie and Ellen who really got us on the map.
So Lonnie, having us on the map with your ice cores, you studying these ice cores and considering that we're calling this 2025 the International Year of Glacier Preservation, what do you want people to know about what's happening to these glaciers?
Well, I think that most importantly is that you should know that glaciers have no political agenda. They cannot be impacted by lobbyists or special interest groups. And so every 2 or 3 years, I have to go out and just check the glacier to see what it's telling us about the environment. And we have been monitoring a number of sites for the last 50 years. And it's monitoring those and having the data that really is so convincing. For example, the Quelccaya ice cap, where we did our very first collection of ice cores from a non-polar glacier in the tropics of Peru. If you look at how much ice has been lost there since 1985, just look at Landsat images, 42% of the area of that ice cap has disappeared, and 61% of the snow cover, which is extremely important for the survival of these glaciers, have disappeared since 1985. And even more daunting is that we, in 2010, we drilled the only glaciers that exist between the Himalayas and the Andes in Papua, Indonesia. And back in 1985, and comparing them to 2024, we have lost 99.99% of the area of those glaciers. And those glaciers will disappear either this year or next year. And the only ice core records from that part of the world will be here in the freezers at Ohio State University.
Oh, wow. I had no idea he was going to say 99%. Brian, what do you want to add to that?
It's vital that we realize this is a salvage operation. These archives of past climate that we have here at Ohio State are really irreplaceable. And so, you know, as Lonnie said, there's no political agenda with ice. It reaches its melting point and just goes. You could make a case that ice in various forms exists all over the planet and will continue to persist. But these particular collections, once that freezing level is surpassed, you know, they go. So it's really important that people get that picture. I would also say that we used to be covered in Ohio by a thick slab of ice a mere 15,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago.
Okay.
And so it's important to realize that we live in the wake of glaciers even here in central Ohio. And so it has shaped our landscape. It's recharged our aquifers. We have a lot to thank for glaciers, and we'll continue to be impacted by them into the future.
An event took place recently in Geneva, Switzerland, hosted by UNESCO and the World Meteorological Organization. Lonnie, can you tell us what took place at this event?
Well, I think the focusing on the importance of glaciers and awareness of these glaciers and how they're so important to billions of people on this planet. And I think the thing that struck me was the number of glaciers that have disappeared or will disappear in the next 20 years on this planet. And the fact that we don't have good observations for many of these glaciers to even note their passing.
And Brian, can you tell me more about, you said that Ohio used to be covered by a glacier, and Lonnie mentioned 99% of one glacier being gone. But to someone just living here in Ohio, why care about a glacier in the Himalayan region being 99% gone?
Yeah, again, a really important question, because the bottom line is we're all interconnected. We're all systematically linked. So we talk about the Earth as a system, where you can't really separate the biosphere from the hydrosphere, from the solid earth we call the lithosphere, because that's the source of minerals and all the elements we need to exist. So they're all very interrelated. In fact, you know, most of our fresh water on this planet is locked up in ice. Mm. And when those big ice caps melt, sea level will rise, inevitably. People will be displaced. There'll be lots of impacts of migration. And where do you think those people might go? Well, they might want to come to a nice growing economy in the center of the state of Ohio. So we're going to have a lot of issues that are related to this concern. But I think, frankly, if we take to heart that we're all interconnected and that we need to take concern for those that are least able to adapt, then this is a very critical moral issue.
And Lonnie, what would you like to see happen next? Are you going to continue collecting more ice cores? Are you going to continue raising awareness? What is your next step here?
Well, I think certainly we have a proposal in to drill an ice field right in the middle of Tibet, actually next year. We'll see how that fares. But I would add to what Brian was saying, that if you take the Himalayas, the Himalayas are one of the areas where we're losing glaciers most rapidly. And if you take just one river that is fed from those Himalayan glaciers, the Indus River, it flows through China, it flows through Pakistan, and it flows through India. And there's a billion people that depend on the water in that river. And 40% of the water during the dry season comes from the melting of the glaciers. And of course, the glaciers are all getting smaller. So there's a huge geopolitical impact of what happens in the future. We have to have water. China needs water. Pakistan needs water. And so does India. They're all nuclear power. They have not gotten along well through history. How do we adapt? And we're part of the world, and what happens in these remote parts of the world will impact us here in Ohio.
And Brian, is there anything else you would like to add about I want to say what an individual person can do, because I feel like people hear about these big climate accords that are made worldwide and promises about 2050, 2060, but what about right now?
There's a lot people can do. In fact, there's a recent poll that came out. It was people were polled after the election in December of last year. And the vast majority of Americans are concerned about this, but the very few people, on less than 10%, are actually talking to the representatives. And most people say that they think Democrats and Republicans alike are not doing as much as we could do to both prepare ourselves to adapt to these changes, but to better ourselves to be able to help everybody else too. And I would add that Ohio State's a great example of how we can bring together multiple disciplines to think about the multidimensionality of this problem. And I would just add on to what Lonnie said, we currently have a project related to the Upper Indus as a transboundary water issue, but because they have a treaty that was formed in 1960, it's an accord between Pakistan and India about the Indus, and really it's been testified as a wonderful agreement because it's kept the peace, if you will. Mm. But what's happening now is unprecedented, and the changes are really revolutionizing folks on multiple levels. But it's not simply a matter of conflict. There's a lot of ways in which everyday people are already adapting and sharing water and sharing water stories. So what we've tried to do through the Mershon Center of International Security Studies, who's funding this grant, and with a collaboration with history and geography and political science, is to get on the ground and to talk to people along the river course on both sides of that conflict and do our measurements and actually try to better share data. So I think that's part of the story, is getting mm-hmm. informed, sharing stories. Personal stories are really the best, and then getting your voice heard by your representatives to express what is most important. And so when I teach climate change, I often talk about this as an energy problem, and it's a problem of relationship because science is a human endeavor, and we really need to talk through issues together. We don't actually, through our democratic process, have all the right ideas in the collective. We obviously are very different opinions, but the strength of it is that we bear those consequences together, like it or not. And so realizing those interconnections and kind of getting humble enough to realize that, you know, I drive a Suburban. Okay, I'm not different if I drove a Prius. We're in this together, right? Yeah. We're locked in. So I think that kind of humility is important.
Thank you to Brian Mark, a leader of the Glacier Environmental Change Research Group at Ohio State. Thanks for being here, Brian.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And thank you to Lonnie Thompson, leader of the Ice Core Paleoclimatology Research Group at Ohio State. Thank you, Lonnie.
Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to hear from Russell Hawley. That's when Tech Tuesday continues on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, and it is Tech Tuesday. A common problem among all smart thermostats is their inability to measure the temperature throughout the house. An upstairs bedroom will have a different temperature than the basement. But thermostat satellite sensors are looking to change that. With me is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thanks for being here, Russell.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me about satellite sensors for your thermostat. How does this work?
Yeah, so most smart thermostats have the same kind of Bluetooth tech inside of them that our phones do. And so anything that's within that Bluetooth range can, in theory, provide data to the thermostat about details in your house. There are a couple different companies that approach this in different ways. Some include moisture and humidity sensors. Some include temperature sensing in things like CO2 detection. But the idea is that you have your, pick on Google, for example, you have a Nest thermostat that sits in maybe a living room, but then you have an upstairs that is often either quite cold or quite warm, depending on the time of year, you know, relative to that living room. And so most of these companies now make these extra sensors that you can put in different rooms and understand, you know, where that temperature is and allow you to make adjustments to how your home is either heated or cooled in order to both save energy and just make your house more comfortable.
Right. And how many should people buy for the best results? Do they need one in every room?
Very much, it's so conditional because it depends on how big your house is. It depends on where the thermostat is in your house, especially relative to an air vent. I know in my house, there's an air vent that basically sits directly above the thermostat. So in the summer, cold air is just blowing right on it, and the upstairs is can be quite warm. There are a bunch of changes that I ended up having to make in my house, including closing that vent, and in some cases during, depending on the time of year, putting a cap on it. And then making sure that there's a sensor up in my bedroom that doesn't have any kind of ceiling-based vents that could mess with that temperature to ensure that that room is the one that is being used for heating and cooling data.
How much does one of these systems cost? I guess buying each sensor is more money.
Yes. So each one of these sensors is going to be on average between $40 and $50. You can usually get them on sale, depending on the time of year, to be able to put in different places. There are ones that offer more functionality, like I mentioned, the CO2 detection ones earlier. Those end up costing a little more. But if all you're looking for is specifically knowing what the temperature is in a different part of your house so that you can make those adjustments, you're looking at spending probably an extra $35 to $50, depending on which brand you go with.
There is one brand. Am I saying, is it Ecobee sensors? They can sense when people move from one room to another.
That's right. So Ecobee sensors use this thing called hall detection, and it's essentially it's not like a camera or kind of infrared or anything like that. It's magnetics. So all human beings put off a magnetic field, and when you walk past that sensor, it is aware that something that has a larger electromagnetic field has passed it. So that you can set one of those either in a doorway or kind of somewhere else in a room, and as you move from room to room, if you have them in multiple rooms, then it becomes aware and can adjust temperature depending on that. That also requires having a house that would automatically adjust airflow, which is a lot more expensive. So it's not quite as simple as it sounds from the description. But if you have a house that is set up for just being aware of where you are in the room, and you can also connect that to if you have smart lights in your house, so that those lights come on as you enter a room. There are a couple different ways that you can really have some fun with it, but it is a lot more work in those cases than just dropping a little Bluetooth thing, than you would with just the data collection part.
Yeah, I don't think that my 25-year-old furnace is smart enough to be able to change the temperature in any room in my house, to be honest.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a case-by-case basis thing here. But if you do happen to have a slightly more modern home that is able to control some of that, the power cost differences can be pretty substantial.
I will dream about better temperatures in each room of my house in the future, I think. Which our next topic can help me dream about that, right? So there is a new a window unit. So staying on top of home heating and cooling, you always think of the old school window AC units, but now it's getting a new makeover. So it's called the Gradient All-Weather Window Heat Pump, and it can heat or cool a 500 square foot space. So what makes this different than those traditional old school AC units?
Yeah, so what has happened here, Gradient has taken the two major parts of that window air conditioner unit, the part that hangs out the back and the part that goes in the front without, those are my deeply technical terms for the day, by the way.
The front and back,
And that's
yeah.
right. And, so the part that's actually, blowing the air into your house, and the part that is actually, generating that temperature, and separates them on either side of the wall, where your window would be. So you actually have a much smaller footprint going from inside to outside because it is just a vent that travels from one side of your wall to the other, allowing you still have full visibility through your window. You can still open your window if you choose to. You can you have the same level of control that you would have there. And the part that lives inside your house is just plain nicer looking. It's a white box that has an air vent on the front and a control unit down in the middle. But walking into a room, you likely wouldn't even notice right away that it was either a heat pump or an air conditioner, depending on how you currently have it configured. But yeah, I mean, this is such a visual departure from what everybody imagines when you think about a window air conditioner unit, especially one that has not survived time particularly well, as you might find in some cases. And yeah, it's interesting to see that there are now multiple companies that are heading in this direction.
Yeah, I mean, over the years, because as I mentioned, I have an old house, so I'm always looking for ways to heat and cool certain rooms. And I've looked for more attractive AC units from time to time, and I find them from time to time, and they're always either a startup or they're sold out. Or they're really expensive. So I guess, is this one very expensive?
So if you go with the all weather version that we were talking about earlier, where it is both heating and air conditioning, they are pretty expensive. They start at around $3,800. And the idea there being that, you know, you've kind of got this all in one unit that you don't need to mess with and can connect to other things in the house. If you're looking at just an AC unit, that price cuts just about in half, depending on who it is that you're contracting with. And like I said, this is not just one company that's working on this. There are several companies that are really trying to just completely do away with the idea of the old school, you know, kind of window unit. And this is the most common approach that we've seen so far.
Now, you explained how it kind of sits in the window and you can still open your window and it doesn't take up as much space. And I noticed when I watched a video for it, it also says their slogan is "They rattle, we purr," which is cute. Is it really more quiet?
It's definitely more quiet. It's using a lot more modern tech in order to do some of the condensing work for the cooling part, and heat pumps, broadly speaking, end up, you know, kind of producing less noise when they're set in that environment. But the other thing that you have is that with a window closed, you can actually close the window. The sound of this thing is outside because that's where all of the work is going. So it is not only quieter by using more modern technologies, but, you know, by having that separation between inside and outside that you kind of lose with a traditional window unit, you're actually getting less sound coming into the house.
Okay. And so you said about $3,800 for it to be heat and cool. Are they available now or is it something that is still like in production?
They are available now through a single contractor that the name actually escapes me. It isn't currently available across the entire U.S., but they are working to have it available in retail stores before the summer.
Okay. All right. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides. We're talking with Russell Hawley, Managing Editor of Commerce at CNET on 89.7 NPR News. And a not-so-smart smartwatch is trying to make a comeback. The watch brand is called Pebble, and it wants to come back this year. What's the appeal of a Pebble watch? I can't even remember when they were first released. The name sounded familiar, though.
Yeah, so it's been a little over a decade since Pebble watches were a thing that you would find in different places. And the whole argument behind the Pebble watch at the time was to get all of the smart data that you would get from an Apple Watch or, you know, from a Samsung watch or from Google, but done in a way that didn't have you charging the watch every day or, you know, kind of having all of your kind of personal biometric data, you know, taken from it. It was just there to provide you with, kind of smart information from your phone so that you could, you know, customize it however you saw fit. The big thing that helped with the cost when this was originally coming out was it was an entirely e-ink display. So basically the same thing that your Kindle has, where it was black and white and you had some pretty limited functionality there. The watch itself was pretty stylish as long as you were a fan of rectangles, because they didn't have like a circular version of the watch, which we have learned from the Apple Watch that not as many people care about as smartwatch as watch manufacturers thought 10 years ago. That company Pebble was acquired by Fitbit a couple of years back, and then Fitbit did away with the Pebble platform in exchange for its own Fitbit service. And then Fitbit was then also acquired by Google in order to make the Pixel Watch. So it's been a while since Pebble has been anywhere, but a lot of the team that originally made that watch and made it popular are currently going to Kickstarter to look at a brand new version of that watch.
Okay, so what do they want to do with the brand new Pebble Watch?
The idea is to take a look at how the tech has evolved over the last 10 years. The displays have gotten much better. Kindle now has a color version of their Kindle display, for its color soft models. So there are a lot of different opportunities to maintain that same feel of a watch that will go a week or longer without having to charge, without losing some of the visual functionality that we're all now really used to with our watches. There's also, you know, wireless data transmission across watches is a lot cheaper now. So things like paying for things with your watch would be possible with a new version of this. The best way that I have looked at it based on the conversations that, the people working on it have had so far is essentially, you know, the functionality of an Apple Watch minus the like heart rate tracking and sleep monitoring and things like that.
Okay. And but it's in a Kickstarter. So this is not out yet. This is still in thinking phases.
That is very much true. Yeah. So this is, you know, one of the things that makes this particularly interesting is, you know, when Fitbit was acquired by Google, they took all of the software for Pebble and they made it open source. It's something that anybody can take and build something with. And so the original team that, you know, made these watches, they still have access to all of the old software that they had access to. So a lot of the different tools that they used that were pretty unique at the time, they're able to kind of modernize in a way that by the time we look at a product launch, likely the end of this year or even next year, could be a pretty, you know, significant departure from the way that we look at smartwatches today.
All right. Well, thank you, Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides. This is 89.7 NPR News.